Hey, J-Ro Show listeners, you might know Public.com as the all-in-one investing platform. Now, they've launched options trading, and with it, they're doing something no other brokerage has ever done before. Public is sharing 50% of their options trading revenue directly with you, the customer. So whenever you trade options on Public, you get something back. And of course, there are no commission or per contract fees either. By sharing 50% of their options revenue, you'll know exactly how much they make from your options trades because Public is literally giving you half of it. In other words, it's a more transparent approach to options with no fees, and you get something back on every single trade. So go to public.com and activate options trading by March 31st to lock in your lifetime rebate. Paid for by Public Investing. Must activate options account by March 31st for revenue share. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosure in podcast description, U.S. members only.
Welcome to the J-Ro Show. On this podcast, your host, John Rotondi, interviews experts in and outside the world of investing. The J-Ro Show dives deep into what it takes to achieve mastery and sustain top-level performance. As a quick reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All opinions expressed by John or any of his podcast guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
I'm John Rotondi, and this is the J-Ro Show, a podcast that explores what it takes to achieve mastery, sustained performance, and longevity. The show hopes to uncover the processes, structures, frameworks, and mindsets that professionals put in place to maintain winning performance in their respective fields. Everyone knows I love and admire Harris Associates' value investing process and philosophy, and that I've interviewed Oakmark's Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager, Bill Nygren, 5 times in print and a couple times on videocast and podcast. Bill was the first guest on this podcast, The J-Ro Show. But what makes Oakmark such a special investing firm is that every single member of the investing team shares Bill's exact same belief in and love of long-term, fundamental, intrinsic value investing. And the Oakmark bench is stacked full of all-star investing analysts and portfolio managers. That is precisely why, if I didn't do this for a living, Oakmark is one of only a handful of firms on the planet that I would let manage my own money. Today, I am interviewing two of those value investing stars, Alex Fitch and Michael Nicholas, on the importance of estimating mid-cycle earnings when performing valuation analysis. Alex is a partner and the director of U.S. research at Harris Associates and a portfolio manager on the Oakmark Select and Oakmark Equity and Income Fund. Michael is also a partner at Harris Associates and a portfolio manager on the Oakmark Fund and Oakmark Equity and Income Fund. Alex and Michael, I am so stoked to learn from you today because I know you both. I've had the luck and the pleasure to speak with you both before and learn from you both before on several occasions, and I admire the heck out of both of you, but also because I don't think what we are about to discuss in detail can be found easily anywhere else. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thanks, John.
Both excited to be here.
Awesome. So let's dive right in. What do you look for in a stock?
Yeah. First and foremost, I would say that at Harris Oakmark, we only do one thing, and that one thing is value investing. And it's the only thing we've done for almost 5 decades now. And value investing, it's really almost a religion to us, and we don't spend any time dabbling in different religions. The foundation to us is this idea that a stock is a partial ownership stake in a business. And it's the cash flows that come from that business that determine the business value. And so we spend our days searching for opportunities to buy businesses for less than what they're worth. We're essentially trying to buy as much future free cash flow as possible per dollar of capital deployed today. And we don't spend any time trying to do things that we don't believe add value. We don't try to time the market or predict quarters. We don't try to forecast macro trends. Our focus is solely on finding opportunities to invest at a discount to value.
And John, we try to avoid being overly prescriptive about what a good investment must look like, at least on the surface. You know, at Harris Oakmark, we have a much broader definition of value than many of our peers, which tends to lead us toward a more eclectic mix of holdings than perhaps what you would find in a typical value manager. You know, some of our value stocks grow really quickly, like a Salesforce or an Alphabet. But some don't, like many of the financials that we own. I think what's important is that, you know, growth is just one of many factors that we incorporate into our estimate of intrinsic value. It's not a different investment philosophy, and growth is not the opposite of value. You know, that said, we do have three core investment tenets that we need to see met in order to invest in the business. We need to see good management. We want to see a path to growing per share value over time, and we need the company to be significantly undervalued. And we won't consider investing unless all three are met. And I'll briefly touch on each. You know, management quality is often underrated, and perhaps that's because it's hard to quantify in a spreadsheet or identify in a screen. But it's hugely important for investors with a long time horizon like us. You know, we want to make sure that the management teams that run our companies are properly aligned with us and that they think and act like owners of the business. And, you know, when your time horizon is measured in just a few months or quarters, I suppose capital allocation doesn't matter all too much. But when it's measured in years, like it is here, then how a given management team deploys that free cash flow can actually dictate success or failure. You know, growing per share value over time is kind of the next key tenet. And this really helps us to avoid value traps, which can be dangerous in our line of work. You know, we're always attempting to invest in businesses that we believe have really a combination of business value growth plus dividend yield that at least matches the market. And, you know, we don't want to get seduced by a low valuation if the underlying business is structurally disadvantaged, impaired, losing a bunch of market share, or maybe just simply rudderless. I think in those instances, you know, time is your enemy and the business is getting worse with each passing year. You know, lastly, we need the stock to be cheap, of course. You know, we're always trying to buy businesses around, you know, 60 cents on the dollar or better. And, you know, we set a sell target for every investment that we make, which is typically around 95% or so of our fair value estimate. Ultimately, our focus is on valuing companies, you know, based on their mid-cycle or normalized earnings power, and then investing in those businesses that trade for the largest discounts to that estimate.
Just hearing your answers to this first question has got me so excited for this discussion. I mean, just from that first question, I took away that, you know, the team at Harris Oakmark has faith in only one investing religion, and that is value investing. We learn that growth is not the opposite of value, but rather an input into estimating intrinsic value. You are not overly prescriptive, meaning that, you know, the Oakmark Fund, for example, has investments in Salesforce and Alphabet and Amazon and I think Meta and lots of other, you know, above average growing businesses. And you also talked about how you avoid value traps by insisting that per share value growth plus the dividend yield at least is equal to the market. And then finally, you focused and highlighted that you try to value all of your stocks based on mid-cycle or normalized earnings power. So, my next question, what are mid-cycle earnings and why are they important?
Sure. So, like I mentioned earlier, when we talk about intrinsic business value, what we mean is the discounted cash flows that the business is going to generate between now and forever, discounted to present. That's ultimately what determines value. I think, as I'm sure you've seen many times as well, it's just never very confidence inspiring, though, to hear someone say a stock is cheap because my DCF says so, right? very hard to have confidence in a black box. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it can be really informative to look at value in terms of an earnings multiple. It gives you this whole world of comparability and context that the black box DCF doesn't. But that context is only valuable if you're calculating that multiple on normalized or mid-cycle earnings. The importance varies pretty widely across companies. You know, on one side of the spectrum, we have a lot of companies that are really annuity-like, where there's a narrow error band around earnings, and you can have relatively high conviction that you're going to get your steady coupon year after year. And the mid-cycle analysis doesn't matter much for those businesses. But on the other side of the spectrum are the companies where you could think of the annual earnings as being more like a coin flip. If you imagine a company where profits will be $1 if a coin lands heads and $0 if it lands tails, the fair multiple for that business might be 10 times earnings. But it would be a big mistake to apply that to any individual year's profits. That company's not worth $10. That company's not worth $0. And the right way to value the business would be to capitalize the expected value of that coin flip, or 50 cents of earnings.
Yep. So
that's what we would call the normalized or the mid-cycle earnings power. And that's what we would capitalize when we're thinking through intrinsic value. Now, that example is obviously contrived, but it really is representative of situations that we actually encounter with real businesses and how we handle those situations. There are a lot of companies where we have maybe very little confidence in our ability to forecast the next quarter's earnings or the next 12 months' earnings, but where we have much higher conviction in our ability to estimate the average earnings over the next 5 to 10 years. And even though the company might never earn that average figure, just like the coin never actually pays out 50 cents in 1 year, it's still the appropriate base for our valuation because it's the mid-cycle figure that captures the intrinsic value.
I don't think I've ever heard of the coin flip analogy to explain mid-cycle normalized earnings before, but I love it. Can you provide an example of or two?
Yeah, I think one good example is CBRE, which has been a long-time holding of ours. CBRE is the largest commercial real estate services company in the U.S. About half the business is stable, recurring, driven by business lines like its outsourcing business, which it provides to corporations across the world. The other half comes from more cyclical business lines, where what CBRE is better known for, whether this broker on commercial real estate transactions, and their revenue is driven by the dollar value of the leases or property sales that they advise upon. As you can imagine, that second half of the business, it bounces around a lot through the cycle. In good times, assets trade hands, new leases are signed. In bad times, activity stalls out. And that dynamic makes it very difficult to forecast earnings for any individual year. The ironic thing, though, from our perspective, is that the forecasting actually gets easier the further you zoom out. I might not have any insight on how much square footage of space is going to be leased in 2024. I can have a much better idea, though, of how much square footage of space is going to be leased on average, say from 2024 to 2030, because I know that over the long term, the leasing activity is going to converge with the space that's occupied. And so that dynamic creates real opportunity for us. We have most of the market very focused on predicting the volatile near term, but our value estimate is underpinned by that higher conviction long term. So if you take that to today, 2023 was a bad year for commercial real estate. I think the general expectation is that 2024 will be another bad year for commercial real estate. We have all this uncertainty around interest rates and work from home trends. And as a general rule, people don't transact when they're uncertain. And so CBRE brokerage earnings are down around a third from where they were at the prior peak. Now, we have no idea what's going to happen in 2024. We would obviously prefer good results, but we also don't care all that much. The thing that is much more important to us is that activity levels will almost certainly rebound over time, even if commercial real estate prices don't. And when that activity comes back, it's going to have a big impact on CBRE earnings. We think it will drive earnings from less than $4 a share today to almost $7 a share at mid-cycle. And when you look at the earnings power and the valuation on that basis, we're paying just 12 times earnings for CBRE, which in our opinion is a bargain price for what we think is a secular winner in commercial real estate services.
Yeah.
And those investors extrapolating the current trend or trying to pick the absolute bottom, in our view, are missing the plot.
Yeah, John, I think banks are another good example here. When you're analyzing a bank, there's at least a half dozen individual assumptions that you have to normalize or adjust for when attempting to arrive at a good estimate of mid-cycle earnings power. You know, if you think about it, there's net interest income, mortgage banking revenue, a wealth and advisory business in some banks. There's investment banking revenue, bad debt expense. Let's use credit or bad debt expense as an example. You know, investors tend to shy away from banks because of recession risks. We, on the other hand, simply attempt to price for it. You know, we know that a recession is inevitable and that one is typically going to occur, let's say, every 7 years or so. So we spend a lot of time, I guess, in essence, simulating how our banks are likely to perform in that really stressful economic environment. And you know, we do that by assessing its own historical performance during tough periods, its underwriting standards, its reserves, and various other data points, including, you know, the estimated losses in the Fed's severely adverse economic scenario and the annual stress tests that they run. And this really allows us to arrive at a reasonable estimate of normal net charge-offs by blending together those good times and the bad times on a probability-weighted basis, and then arriving at that estimate. I think, you know, kind of moving down the list, and I won't go through all of them, but like net interest income is also incredibly important, but it's very volatile. And I think the inability to precisely pin down net interest income in any given year can really be a deterrent for prospective investors. But, you know, in our view, it's okay to be approximately right in many instances. I think these fluctuations in interest rates that drive the volatility in year-to-year profits can occasionally end up really masking the real long-term trend or the normal earnings power of the business. And I think Schwab is a really good example of that. You know, you look at Schwab today, all of the attention tends to get placed on recent trends in client cash and the marks on their securities portfolio. And, you know, what receives much less attention is, you know, the natural repricing tailwind that we're likely to see as these lower yielding securities mature and are replaced at higher market rates over time. And, you know, this normalization will occur over a handful of years. It's not going to be months, but the impact is meaningful, you know, between this balance sheet repricing and the replacement of some higher cost funding. You know, we think that Schwab's earnings can improve by $3 a share or more off of today's base.
Wow.
So we don't look at it as though, oh, we're paying, you know, 18 times, you know, this year's earnings for Schwab. We look at it as though we're paying, you know, 10 times normal earnings for a remarkably good business that grows at a high single digit rate on average over time.
Wow, 10 times normalized earnings for a remarkably good business. I think when I interviewed Bill Nygren recently, within the last month, in a print interview, he said that Schwab was unique for you and the fund in that y'all believe that both the earnings number is wrong and the PE is too low. And so it could be a potential like double whammy, potentially.
Yeah, completely agreed. There are a handful of examples like that, though. I think CBRE also falls into that bucket where you have this very long runway in a very fragmented market that is going to enable this ongoing high return organic growth. But there's so much focus on the near-term trends in the commercial real estate market that investors aren't willing to look past those headwinds and really appreciate that value.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you make a mid-cycle earnings estimate for every business in your coverage universe or every business, every stock in your portfolio?
We do, but we don't necessarily think of it that way. You know, to us, mid-cycle earnings are a way of talking about the value of a business, but it's really, it's just the language that we're using. It's not as much the underlying reality. You know, we could capitalize peak earnings at a low multiple or trough earnings at a high multiple and get to the same conclusion.
Right.
But we like to capitalize the normalized earnings power because it gives us that comparability and context that enables comparisons between companies in different sectors and enables comparisons between the company and its comps and private market transactions. And, you know, I note cyclical investments, the adjustments that we make, it's just one example of the situations in which we have to recast the accounting to highlight the underlying economic earnings power of the business. And there are all kinds of other situations that, you know, fall into that same category. I think software or other fast growth companies where GAAP accounting gets it wrong is one example. Companies with money losing segments that are undervalued by the market. Companies that habitually redeploy capital in value additive ways. And in all of those instances, we have to reframe the earnings power so that we can reveal the underlying value.
Hi, JRO Show listeners. If you were to ask me for three features I'm looking for in a stock research platform that I live in every day, I'd say institutional quality data, alternative data and KPIs, and quick and easy robust charting functionality. FinChat.io has all of that. I use FinChat, I love it, and it has quickly become my go-to data source for my stock research. I think of FinChat as a complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. The platform has a beautiful design and institutional quality data, so it is incredibly powerful and easy to use. Beyond having all the standard financial data for companies around the globe, FinChat has company-specific segments and KPIs on over 1,500 stocks. Want to see Home Depot's average ticket price or sales per square foot? Are you curious about United Rentals' number of locations, market share, or fleet original equipment cost? Well, FinChat tracks all those KPIs and literally half a million more. And if you aren't sure where to go, simply ask FinChat. With FinChat's conversational AI, you can save tons of time researching stocks. FinChat also has a DCF modeling tool, a robust screening tool, 10 plus years of conference call transcripts, and also hedge fund letters, consensus estimates, and tons more. To get 25% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/JRO. That's finchat.io/JRO. The link will also be in the show notes. You mentioned dealing with businesses that sell software as a service or software companies and faster growing companies. So how do you deal with software and faster growth companies?
Yeah, the core issue for the software companies is that in many cases, the GAAP accounting understates the earnings power of these businesses. If you take a software company like Salesforce, which is a holding of ours, when we first established a position in Salesforce, the average GAAP EBIT margin over the prior decade was negative. And you know, that's a fact that I think caused a lot of value investors to shy away from the name. But it was reasonably easy to see that the underlying unit economics at Salesforce were excellent. You know, they build a product once and then they sell it to thousands of customers. Each of those customers pays you annually for code that they've now essentially become dependent on. So it's a great formula and it should have great unit economics. The issue is just that the profitability was being masked by growth investments, things like sales personnel and R&D expense, nearly all of which is immediately expensed under GAAP accounting. In our opinion, those growth investments are long-term assets, and just in just the same way that a factory is a long-term asset. And just like the factory, those investments have a long-term payoff and they should be depreciated over their long useful life. In the case of Salesforce, where a customer churn is very low, the useful life of a new customer relationship is measured in decades. And so when we restated the accounting to reflect that fact, it revealed to us that the underlying business was actually already earning very strong profit margins. And on an economic earnings basis, we were paying a below market multiple for this fast growing company.
Yeah, John, this has been a big differentiator for us in recent years. I think, you know, a lot of value investors have really missed the boat on some of these faster growing companies that don't look, I suppose, cheap on traditional GAAP accounting metrics.
Yeah.
You know, our chief investment officer, Bill Nygren, talks a lot about how value investors that focused, you know, primarily on price to book value were really left behind as the economy evolved in the 90s and the 2000s. And I think the same is true for a lot of investors who focused exclusively on GAAP earnings over the last two decades. So, you know, as Alex mentioned, we adjust for gaps and inefficiencies across software, but occasionally other business models as well. And, you know, we've ended up finding just a lot more value in some of these faster growing companies as a result. And I think the most important takeaway is that it's not at all about sacrificing our value principles. It's entirely consistent with them.
Yeah, entirely. And, you know, hearing Alex talk about this, the Salesforce example, even though they're making these quote unquote investments through the income statement in R&D and whatnot, Alex called them long-term investments and not expenses, because they really do have the potential to lead to, you know, long-term customer value or long-term lifetime value. And so just using that word investments makes you think, yeah, maybe they should be, you know, quote unquote, depreciated over their long lives rather than fully expensed immediately. Excellent example with so far, and especially that Salesforce one. What are some other examples where the headline earnings don't capture the full value picture?
Yeah, Alex mentioned earlier, you know, some companies with money losing or under earning business segments. And I think occasionally, you know, we'll find a company with a business segment that's losing money today and being capitalized by the market at a negative, but where we see real value. You know, when we first purchased Amazon, I guess this would have been in 2014, the company was making almost no money and looked awfully expensive on almost any conventional metric. But at that time, you know, Amazon's online retail business was gaining a lot of share in the fast growing e-commerce market. But given how early it was in its growth trajectory, the business was just far less profitable from a GAAP perspective than many of the department stores and the specialty retailers that it was putting out of business. You know, we were confident that over time, the retail margin would approach a similar level as those brick and mortar competitors. And frankly, that was before fully contemplating the enormous advertising opportunity that they've since unlocked. And I think, you know, Amazon's management team was clearly making the smart decision to plant seeds for future growth as opposed to harvesting profits today. But on normalized metrics, that gave the company credit for margins it could likely earn today and will earn someday, it was really clear to us that Amazon was undervalued. And if you simply just capitalize the current earnings being produced at that time, you would have dramatically underestimated the value of the business, and of course arrived at a bad conclusion. I think Alphabet's another good example. You know, the current quote of $145 a share or so, I guess the company optically trades for 19 times next year's EPS. But if you carefully scrutinize the individual business segments, you'll realize that you're paying just a far cheaper price for the core. You know, Alphabet will have about $16 a share of net cash by the end of next year. And, you know, that I guess that cash is earning higher returns than it used to, but still far lower returns in core Alphabet and could be returned to shareholders today with very little earnings impact. And if you kind of pivot to the cloud business that they have, it's clearly not earning an optimized margin today. They're still investing very heavily for growth, and it's contributing almost nothing to current earnings, but it's worth a lot. And, you know, what we do is we subtract the value of the cash and you know, our estimate of the cloud business from the earnings and the stock price. And when you do that, you know, you realize that you're paying a well below market multiple you know, core search and YouTube and Android and Google's other consumer properties. You know, in our view, Alphabet has no business trading for a depressed multiple relative to the market. If anything, it should trade at a premium.
So a below market multiple on arguably one of the best businesses the world has ever seen, core Google search. And then, you know, just to remind our listeners, Alphabet's a very long-term holding in the Oakmark Fund. And Amazon, when you first owned it, I think you made a quick double and got out, and now you're back in and up from your cost basis there again. So y'all obviously have a lot of skill and put in a ton of work to get down to the real economic profits of these businesses rather than just the GAAP accounting. What are the other adjustments you need to make to normalize earnings? So not just looking at where earnings may be at mid-cycle, but to get a more normal earnings picture. Things like stock-based compensation, amortization of intangibles, non-recurring items.
Yeah, I'd say all of the above need to be adjusted. And, you know, maybe zooming out, we're trying to arrive at a reasonable and highly defensible assumption of the future cash flows of a business. And all of those things that you mentioned can affect the accuracy of our estimates. You know, stock-based comp doesn't directly reduce cash flow, but it's diluting our ownership stake by increasing the share count over time. So not only is stock comp a very real expense, but if the stock that you're handing out is really undervalued, the expense is just far larger than it appears in the financial statements. Yeah. And the idea that the stock comp should get added back to some adjusted EPS or EBITDA figure is total nonsense to us. I think, you know, amortization expense is mixed. Sometimes it's real. I guess sometimes it's not. You know, if it's amortization of some technology spending that will recur in the future, or a patent that will need to be replaced to maintain earnings, it's a very real expense, just like depreciation is. But if it's, you know, the amortization of some historic deal premium, and, you know, we don't anticipate future deals from that company, then it's something that's unlikely to repeat and can, you know, usually be added back to cash earnings in most instances.
As for the non-recurring charges, they can't be non-recurring. The problem in practice is that we often find that they're actually
recurring.
Actually recurring,
right,
at unpredictable intervals.
Right.
You know, if you thought of auto manufacturers, there's always something that pops up. There's always a recall, a restructuring, a strike. No one would say that their best guess of future recalls or restructurings or strikes from now until forever is zero. But by adding back the entirety of non-recurring charges, that's how they're acting. And so the key to us, what we try to do is to estimate what those types of costs will be on average in the future and to adjust normal earnings downward appropriately.
So speaking of non-recurring charges that sometimes end up being recurring, how do you think about a company that is highly acquisitive, grows through acquisitions, and adds value through acquisitions, but it's constantly taking charges relating to those acquisitions?
Yeah, well, if the company is going to be doing acquisitions and taking charges related to them, that needs to be included in the model. That is a very real cost. The more important thing, though, I think, than the charges is the value add of the M&A. Mm-hmm. It's a very high bar for us to believe that a company can consistently add value through deals over time.
Right.
It's a competitive market. You know, capitalism works. If returns on M&A are too high and there aren't very large barriers, competition will enter and compete those returns back down. So it's a high bar for us. Occasionally, though, we do become comfortable that the industry structure or management quality will enable this to happen. Or more often, that a company has some very unique synergies that other bidders can't replicate. And if the other bidders can't replicate the synergies, then they won't be able to pay for those synergies. Mm-hmm. And so in those cases, the potential to add value through future deals, it really is another type of earnings normalization. And it's one that I think investors tend to underestimate. You know, it's amazing how reluctant the sell side is to model future deals, even for very consistently acquisitive companies. You know, you take Lithia Motors, for example, which is a holding of ours. Lithia's compounded its earnings per share from $2 per share in 2011 to $37 a share this year, which is an incredible rate of compounding.
Yeah.
And it's done that mostly through acquiring competing auto dealerships at reasonably attractive prices and then subsequently improving their operations. And yet over that 13-year period, consensus forecasts never captured that value add, and the stock never seemed to appropriately price it in. And Lithia consistently traded at, call it 10 to 15 times earnings. The subsequent stock price performance suggests the multiple should have been at least twice that high. And when we look at Lithia, you know, in our opinion, that's still the case today. Stock's trading at just 7 or 8 times forward earnings, and there's still this long runway for continued value add through M&A. Another good example I'd throw out there is First Citizens, another holding of ours. When we first purchased shares in early 2021, First Citizens was trading at roughly the same multiple as the average regional bank. And that was despite First Citizens management having this long history of growing their book value per share faster than peers through highly accretive deals. Management had done something like a dozen FDIC-assisted takeovers since they took over managing the business around the great financial crisis. And those deals had added hundreds of dollars per share to book value and to shareholder value, but it wasn't being treated any differently in the market than the peers that had often destroyed value through capital allocation. And so we had no idea what would happen next. All we knew is that the history suggested that with this management team at the helm, that something good would likely happen. And what ended up happening was in early 2023, First Citizens acquired Silicon Valley Bank out of receivership, and in one swoop, doubled its tangible book value per share, and the stock followed. The amazing thing is, even after that performance, just like Lithia, it doesn't seem like First Citizens is getting the credit for this value add through capital allocation. And again, it trades like the other regional banks with no visible premium for this management track record.
Right. And, you know, Lithia has a clear runway and a track record of creating a lot of value for M&A. But, you know, oftentimes in a situation where we might be less confident in the structural or company specific acquisition opportunity, but, you know, where we trust management to allocate capital in a really value maximizing way, you know, we'll simply, you know, model increased share repurchase under the assumption that any capital allocation will be at least as good as the buyback at a discount.
And that's an important point, because we're never going to get this precisely right.
Yeah.
The important thing to us is having a best guess in the numbers so that we can be closer to right. And there's such a tendency to shy away from quantifying the qualitative things like management quality. If you don't capture those things in your analysis, you're going to miss opportunities. You know, it's that old phrase that not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. We think it's important to try to count everything.
Two quick follow-ups on buybacks, because Michael, you said that you'll model out buybacks, and will you model buybacks for a company that has a history of buying back stock, or will you take the further step of modeling buybacks for a company that maybe grew organically or grew through acquisitions, but those opportunities aren't there anymore, and so you assume they will start doing buybacks?
Yeah, certainly if the company has a history of doing repurchases and they have an open authorization and we expect them to do it in the future, we'll incorporate that. But what I was referring to is kind of putting a placeholder for value creation to some extent within the business to reflect the fact that we trust management to do something smart with capital over time.
Are you using buybacks as almost a benchmark for capital allocation?
Exactly.
Like the company need, you know, if they're going to reinvest or they're going to make an acquisition, you're hoping that the return on that investment will at least be as high as the return from a buyback. Is that how you think about it?
That's exactly. Yeah.
But the important thing to us in that situation is that management also thinks that way.
Exactly.
Our view, the appropriate benchmark for management's capital allocation is also their share price. And if something doesn't exceed the returns of buying back stock, then we question why they're doing it. For the most part, we are aligning with management teams that share that view.
Right.
Yeah. So we've talked about, you know, estimating mid-cycle normalized earnings. We've gone through several examples. How do you think about the price to earnings multiple that you use to capitalize those earnings estimates?
Well, a PE ratio is just shorthand for a discounted cash flow analysis. And the multiple is largely driven by our estimate of the growth and the incremental returns that we think the company will generate over the long term. It's the same considerations that influence the discounted cash flow analysis. I think, you know, the bigger difference between us and many growth investors is that we're just unwilling to project super normal growth far into the distant future. We've just seen too many examples of businesses that certainly were perceived as highly durable, above average growers, you know, only to hit a brick wall. You know, newspapers, category killing big box retailers, cable networks, we could really go on. So our crystal ball can only see so far. And I think that's a really important discipline, John, because it's really easy to make any company look cheap in a spreadsheet, especially if you assume even a modestly above normal perpetual growth rate. But the reality is that just growing at 7% forever just doesn't happen all that often.
Right.
Now, you know, we will triangulate that PE multiple or the valuation that comes from our DCF against you know, public comps or company's own trading history or private market transactions, but really all in an effort to get a sense of either how the rest of the world or informed buyers view the business value. And I think one of the benefits of normalizing earnings is that it really does allow you to make these cross comparisons of maybe similar companies, similar business characteristics that operate in different industries or sectors. And it can be really interesting to see how investors treat them differently sometimes, even if the math and the business model, you know, say they shouldn't. You know, for example, one of the holdings in our portfolio, Masco, it sells, you know, high velocity, lower ticket home improvement products like cans of paint and plumbing fixtures. And you know, we believe the company's competitive moat and its growth outlook actually rival those of more stable consumer packaged goods companies or CPGs.
Wow.
It's ROIC, it's capital intensity, its margin profile all look similar to the CPG group. And through the cycle, growth rates also aren't that dissimilar. You know, yet we were able to purchase the company at a material discount to this peer group. And I think that was largely due, you know, to cyclical fears related to housing. But buying comparable quality businesses at discounted multiple of normal earnings can be a recipe for excess returns.
Absolutely. And I think that's something else that Oakmark does fairly uniquely is you will often, you know, something else I learned from Bill, you will often create a peer comp group that looks outside the industry or outside the sector when appropriate. So because Oakmark is often buying arguably above average businesses at below average multiples of your estimate of mid-cycle earnings, do you make the investment assuming multiple expansion in your valuation and estimates of forward rates of return?
We do, but we don't really think about it in those terms. Our opinion is you have this fluid relationship between multiple expansion and earnings growth. Mm-hmm. Right? The multiple is just capturing future earnings growth. And so the further into the future you look out, the more earnings growth you appear to be assuming and the less multiple expansion that you appear to be forecasting. And so what we're really focused on is the earnings of the business and what that justifies for the multiples. And all, you know, that often means we're forecasting what people would call multiple expansion, but it's not necessarily a bet on market sentiment changing. It's just that the higher PE ratio is justified by the earnings growth. And sometimes that fair multiple is one that the company's frequently traded at historically. Other times the fair multiple is higher than where the company's ever really traded historically. And we need reasonably high conviction to make that call. But when we have it, it's not something that we shy away from. I think American Express is a good example in our portfolios. This is a company that's consistently grown its business in the high single digits. It earns 30% plus returns on tangible equity. Everyone knows American Express is a very high quality business. And it's very easy to do the math to say this business should be worth more than 20 times earnings. But the market historically typically prices it a lot more like other higher quality financials in the low to mid teens. The math to support our view isn't very complicated, right? We're not differentiating ourselves on doing better math here. It's just that a lot of investors shy away from this type of idea because they can't see a path to it re-rating within their time horizon.
Sure.
And we're very happy to just earn our returns in these instances the hard way, which is rather than relying on multiple expansion, we'll just allow the faster than implied annual earnings growth to lead to above average returns over a longer period of time.
Absolutely. So earlier in this discussion, you talked about how some companies have a narrower range of outcomes and they're, you know, consistently growing their per share value pretty much year in and year out. And you can think of them in some cases almost like an annuity, but other companies are more cyclical or lower quality or whatever, and potentially have a wider range of outcomes. So my question is, how do you, when you're analyzing a business, and then valuing the equity, how do you deal with that, with the potential wider range of outcomes? Are you requiring a larger margin of safety?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time discussing the possible range of outcomes for each of our holdings. And I'd say we deal with it in two different ways. You know, yes, one of them is position sizing. You know, the wider the range of outcomes, all else equal, the smaller it will be sized within our portfolios. And second, you know, the larger the range of outcomes, the bigger the margin of safety must be. So we will typically adjust our discount rates and the buy sell targets that we set for our investments to account for that range.
And in some cases, if the range is too wide and there's meaningful debt, we'll just punt.
Right.
We'll pass on the idea. You know, we're trying to make investments based on our view of business values over the long term.
Yep.
We're not trying to take path risk. And if there's a real risk that the clock's going to stop before the game's over, it starts to look a lot more like buying call options than value investing.
Yep.
And so we'll just move on.
I love that. If the range of outcomes is too wide and there's too much debt, you'll just pass. How does your required rate of return factor into all of this? You know, how do you think about required rate of return and how do you come up with the rate at which you are discounting these numbers back?
Yeah, for us, it's a question of opportunity cost. You always have the option of holding cash or buying treasuries or owning lower risk corporate bonds. And so we look at the yield available on those alternatives, and then we assume that there is some premium that's required to take the incremental risk that's inherent in equities. And so put differently, we don't want to own an equity at a lower expected return than is available on relatively safe corporate bonds. Mm-hmm. So that helps us set a floor for our discount rates that is a moving floor that kind of moves with the current opportunity set. In practice, we almost never find an environment in which there aren't at least some stocks that we'd prefer to those alternatives. And so we're almost always fully invested in equities.
Yeah, and the more practical required return is the return offered by our existing holdings, John. I mean, we're always looking at the relative upside of our opportunity set, of course, versus the names that we own in our portfolio. And for something to be added to the portfolio, it needs to offer more risk-adjusted upside versus the existing holdings that it'll be replacing, or I guess at least comparable upside with some benefit to our risk profile.
Yeah, yeah. And the premium that you require to invest in equities above these safer alternatives, does that change based on the riskiness of the business? So do you require a higher cost of equity depending on what business and which industry it operates in?
We do. Yeah. The wider the range of outcomes in general, the greater the premium that we're going to demand.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. That was such a great discussion around earnings power, mid-cycle, normalizing that earnings power, and then the multiples that you use to capitalize it. Moving on slightly to another topic, how does the analyst team's process work for idea generation and then doing that research on those new ideas?
I think a lot of firms have some type of screen that has special parameters that tells them the most attractive names in the market at any time to focus their work. We think screens can be useful, but we don't have any type of process like that. In a lot of ways, those types of things are fraught. I mean, you're dependent on reported financials, so you might be overlooking unconventional ideas like mm-hmm. the software companies we were talking about earlier. And it's an edge that I think could be among the most likely to be competed away over time, right? If a machine can do it, it's unclear why we're going to be able to do it any better.
Sure.
Everyone on our team is a generalist. Every one of our analysts has their own sourcing process. So our analysts are spending their days turning over rocks, looking across sectors, searching across cap sizes, trying to find value that no one else has seen. And that incentivizes a lot of innovation in the sourcing process. And so everyone takes a different tack. I think the really important thing is we don't force our analysts to find ideas in any particular sector. Mm-hmm. Right? No one's ever saying, we need a utility idea right now, present the most attractive utility. We allow the bottom-up search from the analyst team to tell us which sectors are attractive.
Yeah, and once we've identified an interesting idea, John, we tend to dive pretty deep into the research process. You know, we go through all the regulatory filings and the company presentations, of course, earnings and conference transcripts, and we try to do as many calls as we can with competitors and suppliers and customers. You know, we probably benefit somewhat from better access to external resources, perhaps due somewhat to our scale, like data sets or research access or expert networks. And we definitely benefit from having excellent management exposure due to our size and hopefully our reputation. And that comes with really a wealth of existing management relationships that we can draw on for reference checks. You know, what we don't do is gather information for its own sake. I think a lot of investors act like biographers of businesses, and we don't see ourselves as biographers. You know, our analysts perform deep research on businesses, but they're doing it through the lens of an investor. Mm-hmm. They know a ton about the companies that they're covering, but you know, we're ultimately trying to figure out what really matters for a given idea and what our differentiated view is. And we don't take a lot of pride in writing 50 or 70 page investment memos. And there's certainly no bonus points given out for length. It's actually harder than it seems. It's like that old quote, I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have time.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's just one or two things that will determine whether our ideas will work. And I really think in general, our team excels in identifying those things that matter.
And we don't give out points for degree of difficulty right. either. You know, an investment thesis can be straightforward. It can be as simple as, you know, above average business at a below average multiple. The important thing to us in those situations is that we understand why the opportunity exists, right? What's our differentiated view? What are other investors inappropriately focused on? And you know, those questions help us ensure we're not missing something. So we like to pass the Munger test, right? If we're going to have a strong opinion on something, we need to be able to state the arguments for the other side better than our opponents.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. What else do you think most differentiates the investing process at Harris Oakmark?
I think the discipline and consistency with which we apply it matters. And we're looking for the biggest discounts in the market at any point in time. Figuring that out across a team of different analysts requires consistency. And so we put a lot of time into standardizing our valuation models and our upside estimates so we can actually compare different companies in different sectors and figure out which are most attractive. There's no value in having a bunch of analyst price targets if each analyst is using different assumptions for the economy or for inflation or for interest rates. Mm-hmm. And so we standardize those things to make sure we have comparability. And then I think importantly, we try to avoid contaminating all of that good work and the resulting rank order with other overlays. You know, a lot of investors have incremental overlays on their process that I think distort the quality of the idea generation.
Yep.
They might have a macro view they'd like to express or a bias towards a certain type of business. Even more often, I think there's a desire to hug the benchmark or maintain a certain sector allocation. We don't think about those things. We are benchmark agnostic. Most of us are benchmark unaware. We don't feel the need to own anything in a sector if there aren't good opportunities. We just follow the value.
Yeah, and I'd add that we don't shy away from more volatile names if there's sufficient undervaluation. You know, as Buffett put it, I'd rather earn a lumpy 15 return over time than a smooth 12. And we agree with that. It's, you know, we're not afraid to buy a company that's over earning or that may see a near-term earnings decline so long as it's undervalued. And I think, you know, most of the market is so focused on the direction of earnings changes today that they simply will not buy an undervalued business with a challenging near-term outlook.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, just thinking about how y'all avoid distractions and distortions. In my most recent interview with Bill, I got a laugh out of his answer because it was so short and to the point. I asked him, do you monitor your portfolio exposure to factors and flows? And his answer was, no, we don't think either affect business value. And that was the entire answer.
Yep.
It was just so great. I loved it. Let's see. So what are you looking for in an analyst, Alex?
Well, it's a lot like our idea generation process. It requires turning over a lot of rocks, searching to find the right person, and it might take 300 people to find that one. We want a lot of the things that most investment managers want in terms of characteristics. We want to find people that are intellectually curious, passionate, that have quantitative skills, that can stay rational under stress. I think some of the things that are unique to Harris is, first, our analysts have to be a philosophical fit, right? We have this very clear view of what value investing means to us, how we apply it. And if someone doesn't view the world through that same lens, it's very difficult to make that work long-term. And I think one other very big difference between us and many other firms is that we need all of those core analyst skills to be paired with very strong communication skills. Our whole research process is centered around this idea of group debate and challenging each other and, you know, scrutinizing each other's ideas and communicating our conclusions. And so an analyst candidate could have all the talent in the world, but if they can't communicate their thesis clearly, it's not going to work out in our structure. We're always open to hiring experienced analysts. We're lucky enough to be in a position where most value-oriented analysts around will answer our call, but it's hard to find the perfect fit. And really, historically, our primary funnel has actually been our internship and associate program. The majority of our analyst team today started at Harris as an intern or an associate. So we got the opportunity to develop them as analysts in our method of value investing. And that's a system that's just worked incredibly well for us.
Because your process revolves around discussion and debate, is tough skin a requirement? You know, being able to take the sort of, you know, critical feedback and judgment that comes with these kind of bull bear debates, is that a requirement?
I think you have to have enough humility in our process to be able to admit when you're wrong, or when you know the group at large has made a convincing argument that the assumptions that are driving your fair value estimate are pretty convincing. And I think when we're doing these devil's advocate debates, when we're debating assumptions in an open forum like that, it's never personal. You know, we all work together. We're a work from work company. We're all in each other's offices, as Alex was explaining before, debating ideas and talking about the world. And it never goes beyond the idea itself. So I think we do have to hire people that are willing to accept feedback from sure. a number of their peers, but I don't know if thick skin is the right way.
I mean, I would say we don't pull punches, and mm-hmm. and we just make sure that we're punching the idea and not the person.
Exactly.
And a lot of cases, I think they avoid attacking the idea for fear of offending the person.
The person.
We work pretty hard to avoid that.
Right. You're discussing and debating the idea, not going after the person. I got to say, Michael, I haven't heard work from work. That's one of my favorite new phrases because, you know, everyone's always all day talking about work from home, but work from work is where the real work is happening, in my opinion. Alex, as director of research for U.S. equities at Harris Oakmark, what are your primary responsibilities?
Yeah, recruiting and talent development that we touched on, that's certainly important. Analyst feedback, performance reviews, those types of things are important. We're a little different from many firms in that our research team, our analyst team is very independent, right? They're self-directed. They're all generalists. That bottom-up process means that the director of research nor anyone else are telling them what they need to be working on. So there actually isn't much directing of research per se to be done. I think the most important thing is probably protecting our culture, you know, that culture that we've been talking about where we are challenging each other and performing devil's advocates on each other's ideas and scrutinizing each other's work. It enables this continuous learning for our analyst team. And it's such a good tool to fight against all the behavioral biases that are so dangerous in this business. And you know, when we pair that with our meritocracy, where you're going to be rewarded based on the quality of your contributions, it's really powerful. And Mike and I were lucky enough to inherit this amazing culture from Bill and others in prior generations. And I think it's up to Mike, myself, and the rest of our team to make sure it stays intact. You know?
Absolutely. And I love how you phrased it. We don't pull punches, but we're punching at the idea, not right. at the person. I love that way of thinking about it. Mike, what would you add about what it takes to be a top performer at Harris Associates? And maybe how would you contrast working at Harris to other firms that you've maybe worked at?
Yeah, I think Alex covered the qualities that we look for in both, you know, recruits and top performers very well. You know, I guess I'd sum it up as we're looking for unicorns. As for how I would compare Harris to my previous experiences, I've really never been surrounded by such a talented and disciplined and thoughtful group of individuals in my prior roles. You know, when I first joined Harris in 2013, I was frankly shocked at how flat our research organization is, whereby our most junior research associate is free to challenge our most senior portfolio manager on any decision or view that they have, and to do it in an open forum in front of their peers. And it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how long you've been at this firm. It doesn't matter what your title is. Everyone is held to the same standard. And I think at many other investment firms, that would create enormous career risk for the analyst or the associate. And I think at Harris, it's the opposite. And it's what I love. It's just, you know, you take more career risk here by not speaking up when you have something important to say to the group, even if it's critical. And I, you know, it's a true meritocracy here. And it's a really unique and special culture, John.
There you have it. It's a true meritocracy, and you take more career risk by not speaking up. Michael and Alex, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with me over the last couple of years. And thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thanks for having us.
It was a lot of fun. Before we sign off, I'd like to provide a quick reminder. Anything discussed on the J. Rowe Show by myself or my guest is solely our own opinions and does not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. The J. Rowe Show is for entertainment purposes only, so please do your own research on any securities discussed in this podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next time.